It's a pleasure having Antonio today. He's a student at the University of Rome, La Sapienza, and he's applying for postdocs this year. So he'll tell us all about his wonderful research on PTAs. Please take it ahead, Antonio. And
Okay,
thanks for
thank you. Before starting, let me say that 2 hours ago, I discovered that I am again positive at COVID. So I can't breathe very well. So if something is not clear, please interrupt me and ask to repeat it again. I will repeat it without any problem. So, okay. Today, we will discuss about primordial black holes, how to compute the abundance, and how they can be a possible explanation of the recent gravitational wave discovery by Pulsar Time Array collaboration. The discussion is mainly based on two papers that I have done in the last years. On the first part, we will see how to compute the abundance of primordial black holes, PBH, and in this case, we will focus about the importance of the role of non-Gaussianities, mainly based on this paper that I've done with another PhD student right now in Montpellier in the south of France, Giacomo Ferrante, Gabriele Franciolini, a postdoc right now at CERN, and my supervisor in Rome, Alfredo Urbano. While in the second part, we will focus on the possible signature to the gravitational waves from primordial black holes as a possible explanation of the Pulsar Timing Array experiment. And this part is based on this other paper that I have done while I was in Estonia in June with Gabriele Franciolini, Ardi Vermai, and Bill Hoffman. So, let me quickly explain the main differences between astrophysical black hole and primordial black hole. Astro black holes, as we know, they form from the gravitational collapse of a star. We know that they exist, and their masses are lower bound by the solar. While primordial black holes, in this discussion, in this seminar, we will assume the standard formation scenario, and this scenario assumes that primordial black holes form in the early universe through a gravitational collapse of large overdensity in the primordial density contrast field delta. They can span on a very huge range of masses. The lower bound on masses is just given by the Hawking evaporation. So they can span from 10 to the minus 18 solar masses up to 100 solar masses and so on. So let me explain better the formation mechanism, the standard formation mechanism. Okay, during inflation, we have the production of large cosmological perturbation. In this case, we will focus on the density contrast perturbation. I mean delta rho overflow. After inflation, we know that the cosmological horizon will grow, and when the size of the horizon is comparable in respect to the wavelength of this cosmological perturbation, if this perturbation have an amplitude larger respect to a certain threshold, delta C, these perturbations will collapse and form some primordial black hole. So, what we need to compute the abundance of primordial black holes is this quantity beta called mass fraction. This quantity depends by the probability distribution function of delta and by this quantity here in this integral. This quantity is simply the ratio between the mass of the horizon and the mass of the primordial black hole because it's not a linear relation. And as we will see later, this parameter, delta C, K, and gamma, depend by the shape of the power spectra of the two-point correlation function that we will compute during inflation. So, what is phenomenologically constrained is not directly the mass fraction beta, but is the mass distribution, FPBH. FPBH is simply the ratio between the energy density in primordial black hole and the energy density in dark matter. As we can see from this plot, where on the x-axis we have the mass of the primordial black holes in terms of the mass of the sun, while on the y-axis we have FPBH, we have two big windows in which we can have primordial black holes distribution. The first one goes between 10 to the minus 9 and circa 100 solar masses. This region is constrained by microlensing and gravitational waves experiment, like LIGO, Virgo, and Kagre experiment. And in this region, we cannot have the totality of dark matter under the form of primordial black. But this region, at least for this seminar, is very important because, as we will see later, okay, the mass of the primordial black holes depends by the size, by the wavelength of the cosmological perturbation. For this region here, between 10 to the minus 2 solar masses and 10 to the 2 solar masses, the size of these primordial black holes are related to the frequency range of the nanohertz, that is the relevant frequency range for the PTA experiment. At the same time, we have another window here between 10 to the minus 12 and 10 to the minus 17 solar masses, where we have a white region in which, I mean, we can explain the totality of dark matter under the form of primordial black. For the moment, everything is clear. Are there some questions?
Well, yeah, sorry, I had a question. Like, so for the constraint coming from the gravitational waves, you know, so this purple line, like is that computed assuming that like every one of those black holes will be in a merger or something?
Yeah. I mean, right now I'm currently working with some collaborators from Estonia, checking if these constraints are the same. Okay, these constraints are assuming in a very agnostic way, so only astrophysical merger, and just assuming monochromatic spectra, monochromatic distribution, because this constraint will change if we assume a different distribution for primordial black holes.
Right, like, but you're also assuming something about like the black holes all being in tight binaries that all merge within the Hubble time, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, these constraints are made with the huge assumption on the merger rate. So,
okay, thanks.
Okay, I don't know if I answered to your question.
No, yeah, you did, thanks.
Okay, great. Okay, in which way we can draw some lines in this plot? There are several mechanisms to have a primordial black hole distribution, ultra-slural model, hybrid inflation, curvaton field, and then there are other exotic formation mechanisms like bubble collisions, quark condensates, and so on. In this discussion, we will focus on the first three mechanisms, because only with the first three we are able to have the large production of cosmological perturbation. For example, in ultra-slural models, okay, what we know is that during inflation, what we can compute directly is not the density contrast delta, but is the curvature perturbation. Now, in order to have enough dark matter, we need that the power spectrum of the curvature perturbation, I mean, the two-point correlation function, should be at an amplitude around 10 to the minus 2. But we know that during inflation, the amplitude of the power spectrum of inflation is around 10 to the minus 9. And this is true at the CMB scale, I mean, k equals to 0.05 inverse megaparsec. So we need some mechanism to enhance this power spectrum at the relevant scales for dark matter. For example, the asteroidal mass range, this range here, between 10 to the minus 17 and 10 to the minus 12, it's called asteroidal mass range. This is related to K, to wavelength, that goes between 10 to 12 in the megaparsec and 10 to the 16 circa. While for solar masses, primordial black holes, K spans over 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 inverse megaparsec. So we can have this enhancement like with models like ultra-slural, the curvature field, and so on. So the nature is much, much more complicated as we think. Indeed, as I told you before, here we have to look at the the probability distribution function of delta. But is this distribution Gaussian? The answer is no. Indeed, the relation that relates delta and the curvature perturbation zeta is highly nonlinear. And this relation comes from GR. So it's always present. It's something that is not model dependent. So, also assuming that the curvature perturbation zeta has a Gaussian distribution, through this nonlinear relation, delta has not. Since this non-Gaussianity comes from this nonlinear relation, we call this non-Gaussianity as nonlinearity. Anyway, zeta can have a non-Gaussian distribution itself. And this is something that depends by the model. So we can express this primordial non-Gaussianity in zeta through this generic functional format that, as I told you 20 seconds before, is something that is model dependent. Most of the people in literature, in order to compute the non-Gaussian relation between zeta and zeta Gaussian, they just assume a power theory function in zeta, where FNL, GNL, and so on are independent parameters. In the subsequent slide that I will show you in a couple of minutes, for the numerical simulation, we focus on the curvaton case. Indeed, the amount of primordial non-Gaussianity in zeta in the curvaton case is just given by one parameter called R-dec, where R-dec is a particular ratio between the curvaton field, the spectral field that gives us the enhancement of the power spectrum, respect to the energy density of radiation. And this quantity is computed at the time of the curvaton decay. So we can change R-dec and see the amount of non-Gaussianity in zeta and how they impact above the amount. For the moment, everything is clear. Do you have some other questions? Sorry?
I think no.
Okay, great. Okay, I'm wrong. Okay, let me spend just 1 minute about the mathematical formulation of this formula, because we arrived to this formula, this master formula, to compute the abundance, taking into account at the same time both kinds of non-Gaussianities, non-linearities and primordial non-Gaussianities. So, we start from the definition of the density contrast, we integrate over the radial coordinate, and we get the so-called compaction function. This function is very important, for example, for the experts that compute the primordial black hole formation starting from numerical simulation. Indeed, in the maximum of the compaction is where the collapse happens, and we have the formation of primordial black. Moreover, in the maximum of the compaction, we can show that the maximum value of the compaction is the same as the threshold in the maximum. So we can use the threshold values for the density contrast as threshold values for the compaction. Then, once we get the definition of the compaction function, we can express it in terms of its linear part, C1. And in the presence of non-Gaussianity, C1 is a function of its Gaussian counterpart, Cg, and the derivative of the functional form between zeta and zeta Gaussian respect to zeta Gaussian. So now we are moving to the PDF of delta, that it's not a Gaussian variable, to two new Gaussian variables, Cg and zeta g. So we can compute the two-dimensional joint PDF on zeta g and Cg, just replace this in the computation of theta, and we have this master formula to compute the abundance. Here, the variances, because it's a two-dimensional joint PDF, so we have the variances on the diagonal and the variances off diagonal. These variances, in order to compute the abundance, are computed starting from the power spectrum of the curvature perturbation. So, as we can see, increasing the amplitude of the power spectrum will give us more primordial black hole. So here,
question. I have a question. So yeah, you're using spherical approximation, I believe. Can you comment how good it is actually?
So yeah, we are assuming the spherical approximation for the compunction. As some very recent paper, I think, of Albert Escriva shows, in presence of non-Gaussianity, the spherical approximation is still good. But I was talking with Sam Young recently, and his goal is to try to go beyond the spherical approximation and try to compute again the abundance of PBH. But for the moment, we don't have a prescription to compute the abundance. In general, also to do numerical simulation for the collapse of cosmological perturbation.
Yeah, that's right. So when you say, kind of people say that spherical approximation is good, what do they do? Do they compare with numerical simulations? Or
they do comparison with numerical simulation. And then they have seen that next to the maximum of the compaction function, where the collapse happens, the spherical simulation, the spherical approximation still holds.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Here, what we have? We have a comparison between the abundance, the mass fraction computed with the full formula for the curvature phase. With the full formulas here, respect to the power series test function truncated at a certain order n. Here, as an ansatz for the power spectrum, we use a log normal power spectrum, and from left to the right, we are enlarging the power spectrum. I mean, we are simply increasing the sigma. As we can see, for very narrow power spectrum, the power series after the second order converges very well to the full result, to the dashed. But when we enlarge the power spectrum, the power series approximation does not converge anymore to the full result. And another important point is that the quadratic order, the quadratic approximation, that is the most common used approximation in literature, always overestimate the abundance of PBH. So it's not a good approximation, also for narrow spectrum. Mm-hmm. Okay, here we have the same things that I showed you before. Here there is the ratio between beta, non-Gaussianity with the full formulas, with the different RDF parameters, RDF values, while the dashed lines are the abundance computing only the account quadratic non-Gaussianity. Nonlinearities, I mean, are always present. As we can see, quadratic always overestimates the abundance of PBH, and for RDEC larger than 0.5, the presence of non-Gaussianity in zeta gives us a less primordial black holes respect to the case without non-Gaussianity.
So is that this because point, is that because your GNLs are always negative?
No, it's not only about GNL. Mm-hmm. Because as you can see from here, GNL is, for example, here, no, for RDEC 0.5, you have negative GNL that push the abundance down for the third order. But the fourth order, the fourth coefficient, is positive, but it's still small. So beta increases respect to the cubic order. So, the answer is yes.
Okay. The
answer is yes. Respect to the quadratic, it's always the quadratic gives us always an overestimation because GNL is negative, and so it pushes down the amount. Yeah.
Right, thanks.
Yeah, the answer is simply yes. Okay, on the right, we can see the same plot, but fixing RDEC 0.3 and simply changing the output. But the meaning of this plot is the same of the plot formula. So here, we are assuming another ansatz for the power spectrum, a step, simply a step, regulated by two theta of the type. Here we are enlarging this step. For example, Rm k mean equals 1.2 means that the power spectrum has a size smaller than one order of magnitude. 10 to the minus 1 means that the type is one order of magnitude. 10 to the minus 2, means that the power spectrum in the step is two order of magnitude larger, and so on. And as we can see from this plot, for a broad power spectra, the power series expansion is always strong. And so we are forced to use the full non-Gaussian result. Okay. Here, on the plot on the left, we are always using a step power spectrum, a broad power spectrum. Here we have different RNX values. The Gaussian lines are computed only taking into account nonlinearities. And changing RNX, we can always tune the amplitude of the power spectrum and get the same abundance. At the same time, very next to the bigger mass range, as we can see here, we have the breaking of MH independence in presence of non-Gaussian distributed. I mean, RNX different from zero. Here we have, for bigger masses, the breaking of MH independence. And from a phenomenological point of view, if this happens in the solar mass range, at the solar mass range, we are talking about frequencies that are related to the QCD phase transition. We know that during the QCD phase transition, the equation of state of the universe changes. And so during this period, it's easier to form primordial black. For this reason, in this plot, we can see two peaks. One is the big peak due to when beta ends, and the other one is due to the change of equation of states during the QCD phase. So in the future, we can use the new constraint from gravitational wellness experiments like LIGO Virgo Gagra on LT, Einstein telescope, to constrain models that give us primordial black. But let's focus on very narrow primordial black holes distribution, like the case of the colored Gaussian lines. We have a log normal distribution, and we have non-Gaussianity from nonlinearity. Different RNX. As I told you before, we can always tune the amplitude of the power spectrum and get the same abundance. So we need another phenomenological observable to discriminate models for primordial black hole production. And this observable is given by the induced gravitation. For the moment, are there some questions? Okay.
I have a quick question. Is there any regime where you actually get exactly all of the dark matter for these guys?
All of these lines, all of these dashed and solid, gives us 100% of dark matter.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Great. Now. At linear order, scalar perturbation, like the curvature perturbation ones, and tensor perturbation, that are the perturbation related to the gravitational waves, are decoupled. But at the second order, scalar and tensor perturbation are coupled, so we can produce gravitational waves starting from some peak in the power spectrum of the curvature perturbation. Here we have h squared omega gw is the energy density of the gravitational waves, and it is related to the tensorial power spectrum, pH. Since the coupling between the scalar and tensor perturbation is at the second order, we have that the pH will be a function of the square of the beta. So we have a quadratic sensitivity in the amplitude of the gravitational wave. Here, we assume just a broken power law, and we can see how changing the shape of the power spectra, we have different gravitational waves. I mean, very recently, at the end of June, several parts are timing array collaboration show that the separation angle between two pulsars follow the Helling's downwind pattern. And this is something expected for a stochastic regression of the ground. Let me just spend a couple of minutes on the idea behind this experiment. Okay, we know that in our universe, it's full of these pulsars. A pulsar is a neutron star who rapidly oscillates, and it emits electromagnetic waves with a very, very precise period that goes from seconds to milliseconds. And there are just a few effects that can modify this period. One of these effects is, for example, the passage of a gravitational wave. Now, looking at several pulsars in the sky, and looking at the separation angle between these pulsars, and studying the time delay of the electromagnetic signal that arrives to us due to the passage of the gravitational waves of some of the effects, we can study the correlation strength between the time delay. And as in this case, as in the nanograph case, this time delay, this correlation strength, follow the dashed lines, typical of a quadrupole pattern, also called Helling's down pattern, we can assume that this time delay is due to the passage of a gravitational. This is very clear for the nanograph data, less clear for the European full-spectral timing array one. I mean, for the full dataset, it's absolutely not clear, but with the new dataset related to the last 11 years of data, it's more clear. It's not very clear as nanograph, but it's still good, at least in 3D. Okay, so obviously from this correlation strength, from this signal, we can also determine, for example, the amplitude of these gravitational wave signals. And here we have a quick comparison between several pulsar timing array experiments, like EPTA plus the Indian one, nanograph, the Australian one, TTTA, and the joint analysis. This joint is not a true joint analysis, it's still in work. And I think that they will release the joint analysis in 1 year and a half probably. As we can see from this plot, the most stringent constraints are given by the orange lines, by the nanograph experiment. And these contour lines are the 1, 2, and 3 sigma confidence level. And only in 3 sigma, the data are okay with these dashed lines. What is these dashed lines? It is the power law value that we get, assuming as a possible explanation of this data, the binaries of supermassive black holes, the merger of binaries of supermassive black holes. So the astrophysical explanation does not fit the data really. On the right, we have omega GW for nanograph, the 14 beams of the signal. It's just for completeness. Okay, for the moment, are there some questions? Okay, I think no, so I go on. Okay, what we have done is, okay, let's take the nanograph 15 years data, the recent dataset, and the European DR2 new dataset, the only one showing an Helling's down correlation and not the full dataset, and we perform a log likelihood analysis, assuming two answers for the power spectrum, a Broglie power law and a log normal power, where the shape or the parameter shapes for these for the Broglie power law are given by alpha, beta, and gamma, where K star is the position of the peak of the power spectrum, while A is the amplitude of the power spectrum, while the parameter shape of the log normal is just delta, and K star again is the position. As we can see from this plot on the right, looking at alpha, beta, and gamma, the distribution is quite flat on the power spectrum shape. But the important point is that the position of the main peak is larger than circa 10 to the 7 in this megaparsec. It means that the position of the peak of the signal should be at larger frequencies respect to the last beam. I mean, the position of the peak should be at least here, or at large frequencies. So only the tail of the signal will be inside this first. Okay. At the same time, the causality tail, the tail that we get computing analytically omega GW for k much, much smaller than the position of the peak, this omega goes like k cube times some correction, some small correction, we have that this k cube is too steep to explain the PK data. So the best fit is given by an intermediate region between the causality tail and the peak, this shoulder here. Okay. Here we perform the same analysis for the log normal. And as we can see, again, there is just a small dependency on delta, but after some values of delta, the fit is not good anymore. What does it mean? It means that for a very broad power spectra, the data set, the signal does not fit very well the data. So as I showed you before, a broad power spectra that goes from the nanogram region to the white region where we can have the totality of dark matter under the form of primordial black hole, and does not fit well anymore the nanogram data. So right now it's very hard to have at the same time the PBH as a possible explanation of the full rectangular collaboration at dark matter at the same time. Okay, let me go again this part. So, in which way we improve the nanogram original analysis, I mean the nanogram paper about UPC? We know that from a power spectrum, we can compute the gravitational wave, but from a power spectrum, at the same time, we can compute the abundance of the black holes. In this paper, we take into account the non-Gaussian computation of the abundance, the dependency of the PBH formation parameter on the power spectrum shape, and also the QCD impact on the threshold. Let me explain in details all of this. For the first point, it was simply the first part of the discussion. We take into account the nonlinear relation between the delta and zeta, while the original paper of nanograph, they just expand this formula and use this linear approximation. When we move from delta to the power spectrum, we can see that the power spectrum of delta will be linearly proportional to the power spectrum. So we include the nonlinear. Then, as a benchmark case, we also include three cases for the primordial non-Gaussian limitata. The curvaton case, the ultra-slow roll, or also called inflection point case, and the quadratic approximation. In the case of the curvaton, the RDEC is not trivially related to the shape of the power spectrum. So we use the RDEC as a free parameter. We change it in a free way. While for the quasi inflection point, for the inflection point of the ultra slow roll case, the amount of non Gaussianity is related to the shape of the power spectrum. It is related to the decreasing on the right, I mean to higher k, of the power spectrum. While the quadratic approximation, we simply change FNL as a free parameter. At the same time, nanograph just fixed the value of the threshold, delta C, delta TH, to 0.55. But as we know, there is a dependency on the power spectrum shape of this parameter. So changing, for example, delta, the shape of the log normal, we can compute this parameter called the shape parameter alpha s, and from alpha s we can determine the threshold, the new values of the threshold. At the same time, during QCD phase transition, we have a decreasing of the threshold. So in this part, it's even more easier to form primordial black. We take into account all of these ingredients and we arrive to this Monet plot of my paper. Before discussing this Monet plot, everything is clear. Are there some questions? Okay. In this plot, we can see on the x-axis the position of the peak of the power spectrum, while on the y-axis the amplitude of the power spectrum. The green region are the 1, 2, and 3 sigma confidence level of the nanogram, while the magenta 1 are the same, but for APTA. As I told you before, for APTA, data set is much, much less stringent respect to the nanogram 1. These colored bands goes from the top line is 100% of dark matter under the form of primordial black holes up to 0.1% of dark matter under the form of primordial black holes. The gray band is the abundance computed, taking into account only nonlinear. As we can see, without non-Gaussianity, the signal is in a strong tension with the nanograph data set. For ultra slow roll, for positive non-Gaussianity, we call positive non-Gaussianity when we have to decrease the amplitude of the power spectrum in order to have the same abundance, the situation is even worse. So we need large negative non-Gaussianity to alleviate this tension. So we arrive to the conclusions. When we compute the abundance, it's fundamental to take into account what kind of non-Gaussianity, non-linearities and non-Gaussianity in data in the computation of the abundance. And at the same time, we cannot truncate the power series expansion at the second order because it give us another estimation. And I mean, for very large power spectrum, for very broad power spectrum, we need to use the full formula and not the power series. But I mean, so for many models, we don't know a close relation between theta and theta function. For this reason, many people in literature, they just use the power series expansion. So they start from the B spectrum, the spectrum, and so on, they compute FNL, GNL, and so on. At the same time, if we want to explain the PTA with primordial black holes, we need models with negative, with very large negative. All of this discussion, there can be a potential issue. Indeed, very recently, in a paper of this summer, at the end of July, written by Valerio De Luca, Alex Chiaga, and Antonio Riotto, they show that if somebody, if one takes into account the non-linearities at horizon crossing and also non-linearities in the radiation transfer function, you can see that the threshold value here becomes double. So in principle, if delta becomes double and the abundance is proportional to delta, so in order to get the same abundance, the amplitude is proportional to delta square. If delta becomes the double, the amplitude becomes 4 times larger, and we can fit the data better. Anyway, if we take into account this kind of non-linearities in the transfer radiation function, the formulas that I show you at the beginning of this discussion they do not hold anymore, so we need a new prescription to compute the abundance. Waiting for this new prescription, today I show you just the state of the art of the computation of the abundance, and for the moment, the PBH explanation does not fit so well the PTA data. So that's all. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks a lot, Antonio. Are there any questions on Zoom or on the room?
Well, so looking ahead, so as PTAs you know, get longer data sets? Do you expect that that will change the conclusions here or not?
No, I don't think that they will change the conclusion.
Okay.
The problem is that this data here needs two large amplitude for the power spectrum to be fitted. Mm-hmm. So also with the passage of years, we will have more beams probably, but the amplitude of these beams will not change because the problem is given by these first beams here and also by the beam number 8, this guy here. So, or in the next future, we will show with a new prescription that we can have a larger amplitude, like 5 × 10⁻², of the amplitude of the power spectrum, or we cannot fit this data as well. For example, right now, literally today, a new paper of Riotto appeared with Gabriele Franciolini, Alex Cagas, and 2 PhD students of Riotto, where they show that here, when we want to, here we have a problem, no? Because here we are writing the compunction in terms of its linear part. But this linear part is quadratic, no? So when we want to renormalize, we have a composite operator. So this composite operator will fill the mixing or the mixing of operator. And if you try to renormalize this theory, you have a lot of non-local operators and they depend by the position. So I think that in the next years, in order to be complete for the computation of the abundance, the only solution will be to do numerical simulation and study in any points of the space the collapse. But it will be something very, very complicated. I mean, this is the state of the art for the moment. We cannot do better than this.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Then if I can say something more, I think that the explanation of PPA is probably the astrophysical one. I mean, merger of supermassive black hole binaries, but with a lot of environmental effect like distraction, gas friction, and so on, that we cannot, know how to compute very well, how to take into account very well. I think that the PPA will be related to something astrophysical. But it's just my idea.
So then on a positive note, then how would you move forward then in this mass range where you can have 100% of dark matter, gravitational waves are not really the road that you can go after, then how will you move forward?
Oh, I don't know if I understand completely your question. Your question is, we can use gravitational waves to test a model in which we have 100% of dark matter.
But isn't that dependent on how broad is the spectrum that you have there?
No. This broad spectrum was interesting because with the previous data set of NAMGRAP, the 12.5 was very good with a broad gravitational wave signal.
Right.
So it was perfect to have a broad power spectrum that fitted the NANOGRAP data very well and at the same time give us the 100% of dark matter. But this region here, for example, the log normal one, is related to frequencies that are not testable by PPA, but by other experiments like LISA, Einstein telescope, and so on. So probably we will have data from LISA in 10 years or more, probably more than 10 years. And we will use LISA as a test for models, for dark matter models from PDH.
Sounds good.
So, I have this huge plot here in setup. So don't look at the other stuff. The 100% of dark matter is here. Between LISA, Age, and ET probably is already too small. They already evaporated by open evaporation. So LISA is perfect.
Are there any more questions in the audience? Well, if not, let's just thank the speaker. Thanks, Antonio.